Welcome to Intelligent Medicine, America's foremost program on health, medicine, and nutrition, featuring the latest on both conventional and alternative therapies. Now, here's Dr. Ronald Hoffman.
Welcome to Intelligent Medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. If you've got an hour or two, you can sit back and hopefully you can garner some useful health information. That's what we do each weekend here on Intelligent Medicine. And we invite you to call us. 888-302-3684 is our number. We've got plenty of time to field your phone calls. We already have a couple of calls on the board. And before we get to calls, though, among the big stories that's circulating this week, the Zika virus. Zika virus. You know, this is the latest scourge from the tropics. We've had West Nile virus, a mosquito-borne illness that terrorized the southern part of the United States and the East Coast for many seasons in the past. And then we had chikungunya, which is something that used to be confined just to the Caribbean, but now has invaded southern parts of the United States. And some people say it's global warming, and some people say that it may have to do with the immigration debate, the fact that we're getting a lot of people from south of the border in the United States who may have blood-borne infections. They get bitten by mosquitoes. The mosquitoes, in turn, bite other people and propagate these diseases. It's very unclear how these diseases spread and why they are suddenly breaking through. But the latest is the Zika virus, and it sounds like the name of some bad-tasting soft drink. Oh, I guess that was Zuma or Zima or something like that in years past. But Zika is spelled Z-I-K-A, and it's not fatal. It may not even be debilitating for the vast majority of people who acquire it. In fact, it's estimated that 80% of people infected have no symptoms, making it very difficult to determine whether it's spreading. But the most serious danger posed by the Zika virus is that now physicians believe it may be associated with a devastating birth defect called microcephaly, which roughly translated means a small head, but it's also associated with severe neurological impairment in babies. And so countries that have been affected by this, and this is throughout the southern hemisphere in the Americas, they are now advising that women not get pregnant at this time when the Zika virus is rampaging across these countries. And there are even travel advisories for people from Western countries who are going for their winter vacations to parts of the Caribbean and South America, Brazil, the country that's implicated in this, to beware if they're pregnant, because this mosquito-borne virus has been linked to brain damage in thousands of babies in Brazil. And oh, guess what's happening this summer, 2016, the Summer Olympics in Brazil. Is this going to really put a crimp in tourism to that part of the world? Now, a lot of people say, well, this isn't going to affect America because there are no mosquitoes here. But au contraire, there's a projection that this mosquito-borne virus may spread to all countries across the Americas except for Canada and Chile. Not sure why Chile is exempt, but it has a more temperate climate, and it's separated from the rest of South America by the Andes Mountains, which may pose a barrier to the spread of the mosquitoes. But and Canada is northerly, and yeah, they do have mosquitoes, but the type of mosquito that carries the virus apparently can't survive above a certain latitude. But the concern is, you know, I got to say, I personally am a mosquito magnet. And I'm relatively free of mosquito bites this time of the year. It's January in New York. It's cold. But as soon as the temperature gets up to a certain point, maybe above 55 or 60, I open the windows I'm on the 21st floor in a midtown Manhattan apartment building, and I swear I get mosquito bites sometimes in the dead winter if there's a warm spell. And apparently what's happening is there's a reservoir of mosquitoes who survive the winter in subterranean hideaways. You know, there's a whole welter of tunnels and subterranean passageways underneath New York, the subway systems and so on. And that's where they may reside in warmer temperatures, breeding during times where the surface temperature is too cold for the mosquitoes to survive. And when that temperature rises just a little bit, they come flying into my window and I get bit. So the concern is, as temperature is warm, as we move towards spring and summer, what's going to happen with the Zika virus? Is it going to pose a threat to especially women who are pregnant? This is a big concern. And they're working on a virus. Some people think that all this publicity, they have a conspiracy theory that this publicity is about ginning up enthusiasm for yet another virus, that another vaccination that people can take against a virus. But it may be years, according to experts, before we come up with an effective virus vaccination against the Zika virus. So, you know, that's the latest. I can't tell you of any specific nutritional protocol that's going to minimize your chance of acquiring it. But there's something to be said for healthy lifestyle, the right kind of nutrition, nutritional support with key nutrients. I've written extensively on that subject in the past. Could it make women invulnerable to the adverse effects if they're pregnant? Well, that's a whole other question, because Zika virus is literally creating a lot of havoc, a lot of concern, and outright panic in parts of the Americas that are affected. 888-302-3684 is our number. Let's take a call now from Tim, who's in Sheridan, Wyoming. How you doing, Tim?
Good morning, Doc. How are you?
Very well, thanks, Tim. And you're listening to us on the local affiliate out there in Sheridan?
KROE.
All right.
AM.
A shout out to the folks in Wyoming.
Several weeks ago, you brought up a study that you'd run across on Lupron and other hormonal-type things working on prostate cancer and doubling the opportunity for Alzheimer's. I wondered if you'd had a chance to review that and get a better appraisal.
Well, absolutely. You know, so here's the deal. In prostate cancer, you know, there's several ways to attack it. One is to do surgery, cut it out. The other is to do radiation. And then if those fail, or sometimes just as a preventive measure, doctors use hormone blockers. In the past, doctors used to actually castrate men who had prostate cancer. They would literally remove their testicles in an effort to reduce the hormonal stimulus for prostate cancer growth and spread. That's kind of barbaric. So they came up with the various forms of chemical castration, literally chemicals that block testosterone, and Lupron is one of those. And so sometimes it's used when the cancer spreads, and, you know, there's not much you can do to slow the progression of the cancer. Sometimes it's used just prophylactically. In other words, the thought is, well, you know, we think we got the cancer, but we'll give you this hormone anyway, just in case. And that is a practice that's really coming under fire because there's a lot of side effects of these medications. Number one, they have tremendous psychological effects on men. Depriving men of testosterone has devastating psychological effects. I've had men who said they've gotten Lupron. They'd rather die of prostate cancer than suffer the side effects. It's like instant menopause. It's like going into, or male menopause, it's like getting slammed into a brick wall in terms of your hormones. Men have hot flashes, just like women do, but even worse. They have terrible psychological problems, depression, complete loss of libido. And they also have a much higher tendency to develop diabetes, which is a concern because, you know, they may not die of prostate cancer, but they may ultimately die of diabetes-related causes, cardiovascular problems and so on. And they generally lose their mojo. When you lose your mojo, you lose your will to live. And that can be a real life-shortening event. So the latest is, Tim, that they have discovered that there is a higher incidence of Alzheimer's disease in men who take Lupron. And, yeah, that may be the effects of complete hormone deprivation on the male brain. And there are also studies that suggest that women, you know, the familiar refrain in menopause is that women suffer from memory problems. Well, you cut off the hormones, and sometimes there's a decline in executive functioning in the brain. And so we got to really hold our use of these medications under more scrutiny, because their effects are devastating. And, you know, it's a risk-benefit equation. Are they that beneficial? Can they help men to survive longer, promote recovery? Is it worthwhile in view of all the side effects? And that is a real consideration when men with prostate cancer are given these types of medications. Is it, are the benefits, the potential benefits, worth the risk? I have to say, I have some men who have undertaken programs with these medications, and they've worked very well to arrest the progress of the prostate cancer. But I have a feeling that a lot of the stuff I've been doing with them, the diet, the supplements, the exercise, maintaining optimal weight, that also has helped them stay in remission and kept their PSA low much longer than has been expected. So there you have it on the connection. Does that help, Tim?
Yeah, it does. I've been on Lupron for over 3 years.
And do you have any of these problems?
Well, I've got all of the side effects, the weight gain, the bigger breasts,
gynecomastia,
fat,
right.
And loss of body hair,
yeah,
because of no testosterone, probably. But I haven't noticed any psychological effects at this point.
Well, good. What it suggests is that, look, I mean, all these studies, they said, well, there's a higher risk. Well, what's the higher risk? Well, it means maybe double the risk, maybe triple the risk, but that doesn't mean it's 100%. It just means there's a higher risk. And it doesn't mean that for every scientific study that says this leads to that, it may mean that a certain percentage of people are subject to the problem and others are not. All right. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. 888-302-3684 is our number. And this is the weekend edition of Intelligent Medicine.
A smooth-flowing bloodstream is vital to good health. And one of the keys to maintaining that smooth flow is Kyolic Aged Garlic Extract. Kyolic accelerates circulation, revitalizes cells, and keeps blood platelets from sticking to each other or to artery and capillary walls. You see, the body produces an amino acid called homocysteine. If left unchecked, high homocysteine levels can become a serious health risk. Today, many health experts believe that homocysteine is more of a risk factor than cholesterol. And Kyolic is the only garlic supplement patented to reduce homocysteine levels, a major risk factor for arteriosclerosis and coronary heart disease. In fact, Kyolic is the only aged garlic extract. So get traffic moving smoothly along all your major arteries. Look for Kyolic. You'll find it where quality nutritional supplements are sold.
Welcome back to Intelligent Medicine. Dr. Ronald Hoffman with you, and we invite you to call us at 888-302-3684 during this hour and next. Lots of time to answer your calls, and we got lots to talk about. So let's review this article in the Times about gluten-free diets for athletes. You know, Times gets it wrong big time in this article, in my opinion. They cite the fact that a survey of almost 1,000 competitive athletes in Australia, a sample country, found that 41% currently were following some type of gluten-free diet because they thought it was healthier than their previous eating habits. There are a lot of celebrity athletes who are eating gluten-free. Andy Murray in tennis, Novak Djokovic in tennis, and Tom Brady of the Patriots following a gluten-free diet. Didn't help him very much against that aggressive Denver defense, though. They sacked him and harassed him, and so the gluten-free diet didn't make much difference last week. But they cite a study, a new carefully designed study, they say, of the effects of gluten-free diets on athletic performance. And that study, the results of which suggest that giving up gluten may not provide the benefits that many healthy athletes hope for. Okay, so what's the study? And I got a problem with the study. The new study was published in Medicine and Science in Sports and Exercise. What they did is they gave a bar to the athletes One version of the bar contained gluten and the other did not. Small study, 13 male and female competitive cyclists. So what they did is they switched the bars from week to week. So they either gave them a gluten-free bar or a gluten-containing bar. The researchers compared how each rider had performed and also how they felt when either ingesting or avoiding gluten. And the results showed no significant differences. Cycling performance had proven to be essentially identical after a week in which a rider ate zero gluten or large amounts of gluten. And they also checked for inflammatory markers, and they weren't different either. So the research concluded we did not find a beneficial or a negative effect of a gluten-free diet for athletes who had no clinical necessity for the diet. I mean, they didn't have celiac disease, so why bother? Do you see a problem with a study like this? Think about it. Because right away, I said this study is not conclusive. Because what they just went off gluten for a week, and then they loaded back on gluten for a week. And that's not the way people experience the benefits of a gluten-free diet. I tell my patients, be patient, because it may take several weeks before you experience higher levels of energy, relief from gastrointestinal problems, improved mental focus, and overall increased energy and vitality when you go on a gluten-free diet. Look, not for everyone. Not everyone has to. But a very high percentage of patients and athletes, ordinary folks walking around, will benefit from a trial of a wheat-free or a gluten-free diet. It can really make a difference in how you feel, how you perform. All right, 888-302-3684. That's our number. We invite you to call us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We'll be right back with more of Intelligent Medicine.
The future of holistic health is here. Possessing the power to maintain wellness at the cellular level, RegActive is a revolutionary and remarkable new supplement that will transform the future of preventative and restorative health. RegActive features the innovative probiotic strain ME3, a patented probiotic with over 20 years of research proven to naturally stimulate and produce glutathione, the body's master antioxidant. Glutathione is used by all of our cells, especially in the fight against free radicals, environmental toxins, and the effects of aging. Our levels of glutathione decrease dramatically as we age, leaving us very vulnerable to age-related health issues. Revolutionary, remarkable, RegActive. RegActive is from Essential Formulas, renowned for introducing Dr. O'Hara's probiotics to the United States 15 years ago. Look for RegActive at Vitamin Shoppe, Whole Foods, Sprouts, and other fine health food stores nationwide where Dr. O'Hara's probiotics are sold.
Welcome back to Intelligent Medicine. Dr. Ronald Hoffman with you. And, the debate continues to rage over whether we should consume cholesterol and saturated fat. There's so many organizations out there who tell us to keep our saturated fat intake low, even though we've relaxed our restrictions on cholesterol. That turned out to be a bust because for a while people were egg phobic. And now it turns out the dietary cholesterol, which is personified in eggs in particular, but also meats, doesn't make that much difference in terms of blood levels of cholesterol. And also studies don't suggest that dietary cholesterol has a lot to do with cardiovascular risk. That's really counterintuitive. You eat the cholesterol that's supposed to be bad for you, that they're treating you with statins for, but it doesn't actually make you get heart disease. Well, saturated fats, though, still remain in the crosshairs. And so they thought it would be interesting to share with you a study. It's a few years old, but it's still relevant, which is addresses precisely this controversy. Changes in dietary fat intake alter plasma levels of oxidized low-density lipoprotein and lipoprotein A. Okay, let me translate. Oxidized low-density lipoprotein is the worst kind of LDL. LDL cholesterol, we tend to look at LDL as the sine qua non of cardiovascular risk. If it's above 130, certainly if it's above 160, your doctor's going to want to put you on a statin. But there are different types of LDL. There are large, fluffy particles and small, dense particles. We can actually look at particle size. But we can also look at whether LDL is oxidized or not. Oxidized LDL is dangerous LDL. It promotes a free radical attack on arterial walls And so it's a risk factor. It's actually more important than the overall LDL count. And that's actually a test that we do at the Hoffman Center when we want to assess cardiovascular risk. We look at the oxidized LDL. Also, lipoprotein A, sometimes abbreviated LP in parentheses, little a, is a risk factor for cardiovascular disease. So what they did is they took a small group, 37 healthy women, were fed two diets. One was a diet that was high in saturated fat, and another was a diet that was low in saturated fat. And what they found was that the amount of oxidized LDL in plasma in the blood increased by 27% in response to the low-fat diet. And it didn't matter whether the diet was accompanied by vegetables or not. There were two versions of that diet. One was with and one was without high vegetables. Also, the LP little a concentration increased. So what they're saying here is that low-fat diets do not necessarily contribute to an improvement in lipid profiles. If you look and drill down and assess them more carefully, you may find problems with elevated oxidized LDL and elevated LP little a. So more and more of these studies are coming in suggesting that it's not about saturated fat. And maybe more about refined carbohydrates and overall carbohydrate load. All right, let's talk to Marilyn in Manhattan. How you doing, Marilyn? Thanks for calling us today.
Just fine. Of course, a little bit cold today for me, but I'm better. Listen, it's about my
cold. Wait a minute. It's going to be 40 degrees here. This is a balmy day in Manhattan.
Tomorrow. Can't wait till tomorrow.
Okay, that's going to be even warmer. Okay.
It's about my husband, who was diagnosed with prostate cancer. And he's been on Lupron for about 9 months.
Okay. And we just answered a question from a listener in Sheridan, Wyoming, about Lupron. Did you hear that that call?
Yeah, I did. And that's what prompted me to call you, because this is kind of a complicated case. And my question is really about radiation.
Yeah.
They're now saying, you know, do have radiation. But there are side effects. And so I wanted to know how you felt about radiation. But I really have to tell you that he did have two small lymph nodes, had, you know, little spots in them or whatever. And so they want to radiate both the lymph nodes and the prostate. And I don't think that it's going to do that much better. And that was maybe vitamin C drips and various.
So I don't know that much about her, about his case, but what's happening obviously is that, you know, being on Lupron, you get a slowing of the progression of prostate cancer. Obviously, he's broken through the Lupron and metastases are appearing in other parts of the body outside the prostate. And so when you see that, you know, the concern is, well, the cancer's gotten out of the box, horses out of the barn, now you have metastatic disease. And the radiation isn't going to be curative, but it may be what's called palliative. It's a little bit like whack-a-mole. You know, you see a spot appear here or a spot appear there, and you try to zap with radiation, but it's not curative because the cancer is obviously spread out of the prostate. But it can prevent serious problems, particularly if the spots are occurring in the bone, which can be dangerous. You can get, you know, holes in your bone and fractures. So that's a good reason to do radiation, spot radiation. But over time, radiation is a little bit immunosuppressive. And, you know, ultimately, you're chasing your tail because, you know, a spot appears here, a spot appears there, you know, and eventually you reach a limit of how much cumulative radiation you can get before your immune system is suppressed. So with patients, I've seen many patients with metastatic prostate cancer, and it sounds like, you know, that's a horrible thing, and, you know, there's nothing that can be done for it. But actually, it does respond really well to natural therapies. We've used intravenous vitamin C at high doses with several patients with metastatic prostate cancer. We've held it at bay for years and years. These patients are also on very rigorous diets. There's a situation where we would want somebody on lots and lots of fresh fruits and vegetables, maybe a diet tending a little bit more towards a vegan-style diet, but some animal protein is okay, as long as we're not talking about hormone-laden meats or meats that are conventionally raised. We want the grass-fed kind. That's preferable for cancer. We really want to reduce the amount of carbs because carbohydrates really feed prostate cancer. So there's a rationale for keeping that down to a dull roar. And also certain supplements, e.g. CG, Brocomax, which is sulforaphane glucosinolate, Dimpro, pomegranate extract. These are things that have been found helpful. Vitamin D and the right kind of vitamin E, although there's a big trial that supposedly debunked vitamin E in prostate cancer. Gamma tocopherol vitamin E is very beneficial along with selenium. So, it's a concerted lifestyle approach involving some degree of exercise if your husband's still capable of it, because exercise alone will reduce the recurrence of prostate cancer by about 30%. Flaxseed has an inhibitory effect on prostate cancer. So these are some of the things that may be beneficial. I've listed a whole slew of supplements that are helpful for prostate cancer in my article with D.R. Hoffman. I'm sorry?
What dose of vitamin C in the IV?
It depends on the patient. You know, if a patient has limited kidney function, it has to be adjusted downward. But ideally, we'd go 75, 100, you know, at that high. But it has to be administered slowly so as not to damage the kidneys. So, you know, this is, something that can help to slow the progression of this type of stage of prostate cancer.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I radiation, yeah, okay, that's what they might recommend. But again, it might not alter the final outcome and might further debilitate your husband. So it has to be, you know, kind of it's a risk benefit equation when it comes to the radiation. All right, I can't give you more specific knowledge about this or advice about this without seeing his case, because I don't want to offer cancer advice over the air. But those are some general principles that I think that could help. Thanks very much for your call. 888-302-3684 is our number. And here's an interesting one on, you know, we talk about the effects of soda on kids, and we're seeing an epidemic of obesity. We're seeing an epidemic of diabetes in young kids associated with the use of cola beverages. And so some people say, well, switch from the sweetened cola beverages to the unsweetened cola beverages, the things that are sweetened with NutraSweet or, you know, other types of artificial sweeteners. Here's an article that speaks to that. Just came out. And it has to do with the effect of cola beverage consumption on the risk of early onset of menstruation in young girls. Now, you may say, who cares? You know, well, girls are, it's a trend. We've seen, you know, in colonial times, if you look at the diaries of young girls, often they did not begin to menstruate until they were 16, 17, or 18. But because of increased nutrition and probably decreased physical exertion and unclear factors, maybe environmental factors, environmental estrogens may play a role in this, girls are starting to have their periods at younger and younger ages. It's not uncommon to see girls beginning to have their puberty and the onset of periods at 11, 10, 9 even. Well, what's up with that? So they looked at the relationship between early periods and the consumption of cola beverages. And they found there was a clear-cut relationship. Girls who consumed cola beverages had about twice the risk of early onset of periods. That's defined as before the age of 11. And even if they had artificially sweetened drinks, when there were cola beverages, there was still a positive association. It wasn't quite as high. It was 50% higher with the intake of artificially sweetened cola beverages. And why should that be a problem? You may say, well, you know, girls are maturing earlier. What's the consequence? Well, there's social consequences, but there are also medical consequences, because the earlier you begin your period, the more likely you are to have hormonal cancers, cancer of the breast, possibly cancer of the ovary. This can be a problem, not just a social inconvenience or a developmental issue. This can be a serious medical risk factor for our current epidemic of breast cancer. And so there, you know, and we're not talking fat, we're talking sugar, and even sugar substitutes don't cut it. 888-302-3684 is our number. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. This is the weekend edition of Intelligent Medicine. Thanks for joining us.
Why do I use Clear Sinus Care? Because I like to breathe.
Because I hate having a dry nose.
There are a lot of reasons to use Clear Sinus Care, the nasal rinse and sinus spray with xylitol. But the best reason is because it works.
I use Clear because my doctor told me to.
Because it's all natural.
Clear, spelled X-L-E-A-R, moisturizes and soothes those dry and irritated sinuses. Clear Sinus Care not only helps with dry air problems, it also helps wash away pollens, pollutants, and other airborne contaminants, making your sinus passageways all clear.
Because my snoring was keeping my wife awake.
Because now I'm not all stuffed up.
And because it's all natural, Clear is 100% safe for children. The perfect way to keep your whole family healthy and breathing right. Prevent the misery and stop the suffering with Clear. That's X-L-E-A-R at clear.com and fine retailers.
Available at Whole Foods, Vitamin Shop, and other fine natural products retailers.
Welcome back to Intelligent Medicine. Dr. Ronald Hoffman with you, and let's talk vitamin D. Yeah, one of my favorite subjects. And, you know, these days, doctors still, you know, they've moved the dial just a little bit on their vitamin D recommendations. They used to say don't take more than 400 international units of vitamin D. That'll get you nowhere. Now, a little more liberal with their recommendations. They'll say, oh, you can take 1,000. Occasionally run across a doctor and say, well, you could take 2,000. But when they see the doses that I put patients on, they freak and tell their patients that they're going to be at risk of grievous harm because they're taking too much vitamin D. So I'll share with you a study, very interesting study, done a couple years ago that looks at how much vitamin D does it take to get you up to a good level if you are deficient. The study was done in a children's hospital where they looked at adolescents, average age 16 and a half, and they had low vitamin D. How low was their vitamin D? It was around 14. Okay, you know that 20 is considered the borderline for sufficiency, but in terms of optimum, we're shooting for 40. Okay, most of you know that at this point because we've been talking about it ad nauseum here on this program. So vitamin D deficient adolescents were placed into three different supplementation groups. One group got just 1,000 IUs per day, which is kind of what they say you should take. They didn't get any vitamin D before. They said, well, let's give you some vitamin D. We'll start with 1,000. Another group got 5,000 per day. And another group got even more. They got 50,000 per week, which averages out to, you do the math, around 7,000 per day. And they did this for a period of 8 weeks. And then they were retested. And the results were kind of interesting. Because in the group that took 1,000 international units of vitamin D, only 2% achieved vitamin D sufficiency. On the average, their vitamin D went up just 6 points. So it went from 16 to 22. That's, just barely across the border of the deficiency mark, which is 20. But that's not so good. They did not achieve, only 2% achieved vitamin D sufficiency, which was defined as 40. Okay, so what about the group that took 5,000 a day? That sounds like a lot. Still, they only went up 15 points after 8 weeks. So let's do the math. They started out at 14, and then they went up to 29. Okay. 14 plus 15, 29. Check my math. So that's a little better, but still only about half of them, 56% of them, achieved sufficiency after 8 weeks of this high-dose vitamin D, 5,000. What about the 50,000 IUs per week group? Well, 72% of them achieved sufficiency, which means that 28% did not. And their vitamin D went up 25 points. So if you do the math, 14 plus 25, they got up to about 39 on average, or 40. They hit, you know, so they mostly hit the mark with 50,000 international units per week. And what they noticed is that obese adolescents had much less change in their vitamin D levels after treatment than normal weight participants. So if you're overweight, that's going to make it even harder for you to achieve vitamin D adequacy. The conclusion of the study, adult-sized adolescents require 8 weeks of high-dose vitamin D, at least 5,000 per day, preferably 50,000 per week to correct deficiency. And if they're overweight, they might need even more, or for a more prolonged period. Interesting study. All right. This item has to do with magnesium and diabetes. There's an article that appears on our website at drhoffman.com about the relationship between magnesium consumption and a form of cancer, pancreatic cancer. Well, why might magnesium help the pancreas from going towards cancer? Pancreas is the source of insulin. And it just may be that an overworked pancreas that's working harder and harder to pump out insulin can go awry. Cells can mutate, and you can develop abnormal cells, which ultimately lead to cancer. So here's a study that talks about the relationship between magnesium intake and another important function of the pancreas, the risk of type 2 diabetes. And what they found is a big study. They looked at 25,000 cases, and they found a significant inverse association between magnesium intake and the risk of type 2 diabetes. In other words, the less magnesium, the higher the risk. The more intake, the lower the risk of type 2 diabetes. And this strongly suggests that magnesium has a lot to do with the sugar metabolism, which, if efficient, can help you avert excess production of insulin, which is highly associated with the risk of type 2 diabetes. Type 1 diabetes, not enough insulin. Type 2 diabetes, your pancreas is working overtime, pumping out insulin, and maybe that stress on the pancreas also may lead to a higher risk of pancreatic cancer. We know that diabetes, type 2, pancreatic cancer are very closely linked. All right, that wraps up for this hour. Please check out drhoffman.com because I got a very, very detailed rebuttal to the scurrilous frontline program on PBS that was a hit piece on supplements. We'll talk a little bit about that next hour. Plus, we'll take your phone calls. Get ready to call. 888-302-3684 is our number. We're standing by to answer your questions on intelligent medicine.